You're listening to SurgeCast, a podcast made specifically for busy general surgery residents. Okay, welcome back, everyone. We're now in season 6 of SurgeCast. The next section is one that's really short, and that's the spleen. So we've kind of broken it up into two different lectures or podcasts. The first one is going to be hematologic diseases of the spleen, and we're also going to incorporate how to do a splenectomy, both open and laparoscopic in this one. And then the second one is going to be on splenic abscesses, cysts, and neoplasms. I'll start off real quick just kind of by reviewing the anatomy of the spleen, which is relatively basic, and just some basic physiology as well. So there's a couple ligaments that hold the spleen in place. Two of them are avascular, so that's the splenocolic and the splenophrenic ligaments. And then the gastrosplenic ligament is the one that contains the short gastric vessels, and the splenorenal ligament contains the splenic artery and vein. As far as the arterial supply to the spleen goes, it's mostly through the short gastrics and the splenic artery. Functionally, you can think about the spleen as having kind of immunologic function mostly, as well as a reservoir for the spleen. So 85% of the parenchyma you can think of as red pulp, and then 15% as white pulp. The part that's red is the part that's kind of responsible for filtering red blood cells. And then the white pulp is primarily the immunologic portion of it, which functions in terms of bacterial clearance, functions as an antigen processing center for macrophages, and then is also one of the largest producers of IgM. So moving forward, we can talk about two kind of big diseases, which I always get confused. The most kind of frequently tested one is ITP, or idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, and the other one is thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or TTP. So Catherine, why don't you kick it off with ITP?
Sure. So ITP, first of all, let's go ahead and really define what this is in order to differentiate it from TTP later. So ITP is an autoimmune disease. And basically what happens is there are antibodies, which are IgG, which are formed against the fibrinogen receptor. And remember, that's that 2B3A receptor that you probably learned about in medical school. And the attack by those antibodies results in a decreased platelet count. So the epidemiology of this is there's basically 50 to 100 per 1 million people a year who are diagnosed with this condition. Half of all of those are going to show up in kids, and there's multiple immune-related genes that are associated with that, but none of those things are tested on the abscite. In adults, this generally becomes a chronic condition and something that people will struggle with for significant periods of time. Slightly more common in women, 1.2 to 1.7 to 1. And then the median age of diagnosis in adults is 50 to 60. So the way this gets presented on the abscite is, you know, a 55-year-old woman comes in with, you know, something like chronic bruising and bleeding. So how do you actually diagnose it in a patient? Basically, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. You really need to rule out all of the other causes of low platelet counts for these patients before you call it ITP. So you need to rule out things like leukemia, medications those patients are on, lupus, HIV, von Willebrand's factor, or HIT. And then the real criteria is thrombocytopenia. So a platelet level less than 150,000 leading to petechiae, soft tissue ecchymosis, and bruising. And it's important to remember here, these patients do not have splenomegaly. They will have normal spleens. The first step for treating these patients is non-operative. So first, and this is definitely tested on the abscite, first line of treatment is steroids. Next thing you can try is IVIG. That's going to be reserved for patients who have poor response to other treatments or those who are scheduled for surgery who have too low a platelet count to undergo surgery. Thrombopoietin receptor agonists can be used to stimulate platelet production by the bone marrow. And then finally, platelet transfusions are only used in emergency situations, like bleeding patients with very low platelet counts. And the reason is giving these patients platelets really is a futile exercise. Any platelets you give them are just going to continue to be attacked by their own antibodies and destroyed.
Yeah, so I'll go over kind of the operative treatment, starting with an open splenectomy. And so the indication for an open splenectomy in a patient with ITP would be somebody who is A, refractory to treatment with steroids, and B, has a platelet count of less than 10,000 for at least 6 weeks. So going over the steps of an open splenectomy, generally we do this more in kind of trauma situations or if there's massive splenomegaly, but it's important to know just in case for some reason you have to convert or you know, just in general as well. So just remember that kind of upfront, any patient that you plan to do an elective splenectomy on needs their vaccinations 1 week preoperatively. And so again, that's going to be your pneumococcal vaccination, meningococcal vaccination, and the Haemophilus influenza vaccination. So you can do this one of two ways. You either start with a midline incision or a left costal margin incision. I'd use a midline if there was any concern for rupture or if the spleen itself was quite large. You can use a left costal margin incision if it's a very kind of well-planned elective procedure. Mobilize the spleen by dividing the ligamentous attachments. Those are the ones we talked about before, the gastrosplenic, splenocolic, splenorenal, and splenophrenic. Get into the lesser sac and then incise the lateral attachments, the retroperitoneum. Make sure that you're performing an individual ligation and division of all the splenic vessels and start with the splenic artery. The next thing you're going to do is ensure that you've protected the tail of the pancreas because the tail of the pancreas is often near the splenic hilum. And I've actually seen this before where patients who have had a splenectomy will end up with a pancreatic leak that requires drainage and kind of the whole nine yards. Lastly, you want to check for any accessory spleens. And when I say accessory spleens, I mean spleens that are not in the kind of the general location. And so that happens in about 10% of the population will actually have an accessory spleen. And this is something I've seen tested on the AB site. The most common location would be in the splenic hilum. And finally, if there's no accessory spleens, then you can go ahead and close. Catherine, can you walk us through the laparoscopic splenectomy?
Sure. So a laparoscopic splenectomy is now the gold standard for patients with normal size spleens. That's mostly due to decreased intraoperative blood loss, shorter length of stay. You can also then do a hand-assisted splenectomy for patients that have much larger spleens. So any laparoscopic operation, the first thing you want to think about is patient positioning and ports. So patient needs to be in kind of the right side down, semi-lateral decubitus position. You want to put those ports in the mid-clavicular line, 6 centimeters above the costal margin. Then you have 3 5-millimeter ports parallel to the costal margin from just left of midline to the mid-axillary line, and a 12-millimeter port inferior to the first 3 ports. That's your camera port. Next, you want to mobilize the inferior pole of the spleen by dividing the ligamentous attachments, by dividing the splenocolic ligament. Next, you want to divide the splenorenal ligament. Division of the gastrosplenic ligament containing the short gastrix with bipolar cautery or the haronic scalpel. You'll identify the splenic artery and vein, divide those using a vascular stapler. Make sure it's very hemostatic. This is kind of the big major area of risk in a laparoscopic procedure is ensuring hemostasis. For spleens that are particularly large, you may need to upsize your 12-millimeter port to an 18-millimeter port, or the spleen can be morselized if required for retrieval.
Excellent. And so just talking about the follow-up, one thing you want to watch out for is what's called OPSI, or overwhelming post-splenectomy infection, also known as kind of post-splenectomy sepsis. This is generally about a 0.1% risk after patients have their spleens taken out, but there's a lot of questions on the AB site that kind of focus on this. So the most common cause is strep pneumo, followed by H flu, and then Neisseria meningitis. This is usually due to a lack of immunity that's lost when you are no longer able to have that kind of IgM response to encapsulated bacteria. And when you know you get tested on this, sometimes they'll kind of harp on the distinction between children and adults. And so remember that in children, you want to avoid a splenectomy if you can before the age of 5 years old. And the reason for that is that they actually have a higher risk of overwhelming post-splenectomy infection. And then finally, they'll ask a lot about kind of the vaccination regimens. And so remember, if it's going to be an elective splenectomy, you want to make sure you're vaccinating them at least 7 to 14 days beforehand. And if it's an emergency splenectomy, then after 14 days after the spleen has been taken out. And then remember that there's going to be some kind of normal changes that you expect after splenectomy. So there'll be a transient thrombocytosis, there'll be a transient or perhaps even persistent leukocytosis. And so it's not uncommon that we see patients on the floor afterwards who have had their spleen taken out that have a pretty high white count. And then as far as the red blood cell changes in and of themselves go, This is a throwback to step one. You'll see some HAL Jolly bodies, which are essentially nuclear remnants that you see in the red blood cells. There's Heinz bodies that are denatured hemoglobin cells, or excuse me, hemoglobin chains. There's target cells and then spur cells. Okay, so that's a lot. Let's move on now to thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura.
So thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or TTP, basically how to diagnose this, it's associated with infection, inflammation, or autoimmune disease, but isn't in and itself caused by that. And so it's due to a loss of platelet inhibition, and that's due to a lack of activity of Adams T S13 enzyme, which leads to thrombosis and infarction. The symptoms of this are purpura, fever, renal dysfunction, hemolytic anemia, and stroke. And then the treatment for this is immunosuppression, plasmapheresis, but not splenectomy. And so that's what really differentiates this from ITP. And making that that diagnosis is really essential in order to avoid an unnecessary splenectomy.
Excellent. Okay, so now we're just going to go through kind of a grab bag of some other splenic disorders you might get tested on. The first one here is beta thalassemia. Remember, that's an autosomal dominant disorder. It's usually medically treated with blood transfusions or iron chelators. But you can opt for splenectomy if there's a patient that has a kind of massive splenomegaly or, is having a lot of symptoms, things like that. And that's because, generally speaking, that tends to decrease the amount of hemolysis that they're experiencing.
Next one is spherocytosis, which is actually the most common cause of congenital anemia. That's due to a spectrin deficit, which deforms the red blood cells, leading to splenic sequestration and splenomegaly. These patients should get a splenectomy. That's curative for them. And at the same time, often people will elect to perform a cholecystectomy, and that's due to the risk of pigmented stone formation.
Okay. The next one is G6PD disorder. So that is an enzyme deficiency that leads to increased oxidative stress in red blood cells. And so folks end up with kind of an anemia that's precipitated whenever they're under some sort of stressor, like an infection, some sort of medication, or one of the step one favorites, the fava beans. And again, remember that splenectomy is usually not required in these folks.
Next one is sickle cell disease. So this is an autosomal recessive disorder. It does lead to splenomegaly and then eventual autoinfarction of the spleen. This is due to a hemoglobin A chain being replaced with a hemoglobin S chain, which leads to sickling of the red blood cells, especially in response to stress. Because these patients eventually have autoinfarction of their spleens, they don't really require splenectomy. And then before we move on from this topic, Rahul, I want to hit one more thing about the spleen that's really highly tested on the ABSITE. Could you tell me kind of what causes splenic vein thrombosis and what are the complications of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, this is something that I've seen on the ABSITE a couple times here. So in a patient that has isolated gastric varices, this is the way I've seen it tested, is they'll say this patient has isolated gastric varices, and what is kind of the most common cause of this? And the answer is splenic venous thrombosis, or they'll kind of hint towards a history of pancreatitis, things like that. So what ends up happening is this. Patient comes in and they've had multiple attacks of pancreatitis. The splenic vein kind of sits and runs behind the pancreas in kind of a left to right fashion. And the inflammation that's happening in the pancreas ends up irritating the vein itself, which causes it to have thrombosis and then back up all the way to the gastric veins as well. And so just remember that any patient that's presenting with isolated gastric varices is probably due to splenic venous thrombosis, or they have a history of pancreatitis. Okay, so I think that brings us to the end of this kind of long and quite dense lecture, but we'll move on now to the high points. So the first one is, what is the cause of ITP, and when is a splenectomy indicated in patients with ITP?
So ITP is an autoimmune disease with IgG antibodies against the fibrinogen receptor, that's that 2BA3A receptor, which results in a decreased platelet count. Splenectomy is indicated in patients with ITP, which is refractory to steroids, who have a platelet count less than 10,000 for 6 weeks.
Awesome. Okay. So let's contrast that now with TTP. What is the cause of TTP, and how do you treat TTP?
So TTP is due to loss of platelet inhibition due to the lack of an activity of the Adams T S13 enzyme that leads to thrombosis and infarction. The treatment for that is plasmapheresis and immunosuppression, but not splenectomy.
Okay. And what's the most severe complication that patients can experience after they've had their spleen out?
So that's OPSI, or post-splenectomy sepsis. That's less than a 1% risk after splenectomy, most commonly due to strep pneumo, H flu, or Neisseria meningitis, and it's due to specific immunity, loss of that IgM to encapsulated bacteria.
Okay. What's the most common indication for an open splenectomy?
Open splenectomy is going to be indicated for massive splenomegaly or trauma.
Okay. And finally, where are the vessels that feed the spleen located?
So the gastrosplenic ligament has the short gastric vessels, and then the splenorenal ligament has the splenic artery and vein.
Awesome. Okay, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this one. We will see you next time for the second half of spleen. Thanks again for listening to SearchCast.
You can find SearchCast on Spotify or iTunes. Make sure you follow us on Instagram or Twitter @SearchCastPodcast, or find us at searchcastpodcast.com.